It's my pleasure to be here and to share with you. This is a truncated version of some longer projects, research projects I'm working on, and I will try and get through it as quickly as possible to leave some time for some questions and to keep us on schedule. The concept of truth and ecclesiological authority have scientists replaced priests. The thesis of this paper is that there is a strong and growing parallel between how scientists and Catholic priests function in relationship to their respective bodies politic, that is, the general public and church members or the ecclesiological body. Some Catholic theologians are very well aware of this and its implications in today's world, although far fewer evangelicals or Seventh-day Adventists seem to be as aware. Accordingly, the purpose of this study is to provide a backdrop from which tentative and further lessons for Seventh-day Adventist theologians and the development of our theology could be derived that are particularly relevant, and hopefully also, of course, for anyone else, that are particularly relevant in the 21st century at a time when conversations about science and religion continue at a contentiously high pitch. In preview, this paper will address, first, some contemporary background details concerning why the rising secular scientific priesthood is a pressing problem. Second, a somewhat detailed review of the current relationship between science and religion today will further explain the context for how the situation has developed. Third, I will briefly review why science was religion historically. Science was religion historically, particularly through Platonism and Neoplatonic theurgy and other practices, in order to understand why, fourthly, Neoplatonic theurgy is the root and the inspiration of the Catholic sacramental priesthood. Fifthly, I will conclude by noting that the secular science and the all-encompassing emerging culture of ethics it has generated and the priesthood it creates is the greatest competition to Catholicism, and Catholics know this. Not because of its incompatible methods, rather they are in fact identical, or results, but because of their parallelism, and such parallels while drawing them both, secular science and sacramental science, into an uneasy convergence which is, not so indirectly, presenting the greatest challenge for Catholicism in its history. Some contemporary context, Francis versus Benedict is a reflection of this, the left versus the right, two sides of the same false coin. Science focused more on nature and social concerns versus science focused more on innate reason, tradition, and personal edification. Plato versus Aristotle with Neoplatonism sandwiched in between. A great meal. That last sentence was very important. Thus, above and beyond Catholicism's direct influence, the Platonic philosophical brick against which Catholicism strikes its matches is leading them both, the logs of secular science and sacramental science, toward the fiery question, when is it appropriate to coerce another person or people for the sake of the truth or the good? The tentative advice I'll share for Adventists, then, is whether we wish to participate in the converging secular and religious parallelism at play between secular science and sacramental science, or whether we wish to be their true antithesis and seek our rest in the theophonic logos of Scripture, the God who speaks. God is not found in the certainty of rationalistic assent, but in the ongoing historical appearance of his activities, of which we receive a testimony through his word. It is a very different kind of certainty, philosophically speaking, than the heritage that Christianity has become accustomed to. Contemporary background. In light of the proposal I'm offering, it is indeed an irony that science and religion are often seen to be at odds with each other. I would suggest that the reason science and religion may be seen to be at odds with each other is due to how they define themselves, and even more specifically, how they treat the object of their inquiry. To do so will require a review of how they view the question of truth and how and explore how this impacts the discussions between science and religion at a foundational level, which, it seems, thus far, only Catholics fully appreciate. Notably, upon unpacking this just a little, there will be new areas of harmony and conflict that will emerge for reasons that are usually neglected by both scientists and theologians. One would think that what is truly objective can't be manipulated, cannot be played with. This is not so, however, for some very complicated reasons I can only barely touch today. What has motivated this paper, to jump into the contemporary context, is a growing pattern of truth misuse or truth abuse, wherein scientists presume the authority to use their purported discoveries for ethical, a word that must be italicized, ends in the social sphere. Popular author, atheist, and professional biologist Sam Harris, who does not believe in the existence of free will, to further tell you where these people often end up in the academy, demonstrates this ethical impulse in his thinking very clearly when he urges that science can and should determine human morality. Harris explains, if there are right and wrong answers to ethical questions, these answers will be best sought in the living present alone. No need for the humanities and history. The pervasive idea that religion is somehow the source of our deepest ethical intuitions is absurd. We no more get our sense that cruelty is wrong from the pages of the Bible than we get our sense that 2 plus 2 equals 4 from the pages of a textbook on mathematics. That is from Harris, The End of Faith. Elsewhere, Harris continues, while the argument I make in this book, the second book, The Moral Landscape, is bound to be controversial, it rests on a very simple premise. Human well-being entirely depends on events in the world and on states of the human brain, which, of course, scientists can best determine. Consequently, there must be scientific truths to be known about it. A more detailed understanding of these truths will force us to draw clear distinctions between different ways of living in society and with one another, judging some to be better or worse, more or less true to the facts, and more or less ethical. Clearly, such insights could help us to improve the quality of human life. And this is where academic debate ends and choices affecting the lives of millions of people begin. Harris, The Moral Landscape. A very challenging predicament is presented through the use of scientists like Harris, access to specialized data to influence, often through politics, the imposition of ethical demands on others. For example, regulations to address, if nothing else, the hot topic of global warming. It virtually becomes a matter of ex opere operato, from the work worked. We should believe what scientists say because they have a credibility we don't, successes we have not achieved, for example, especially in technology. And thus we are credited with wisdom when we unthinkingly submit. Science is pure, we are told. The overall purity or goodness of the individual scientist or we, the recipient of their science, is less important, just as it is with the sacraments, than the pure science they mediate to us in their collective but inaccessible or incomprehensible to the public studies and data. Understand, I'm not concerned with whether or not my example of global warming exists. The problem is that whether or not human-caused global warming exists, in neither case is it seemingly verifiable by the body politic. There is no priesthood of every citizen at play here. Scientists, rather, operate as a cult of experts that mediate the results of their studies to the public alongside ethical recommendations or demands when they can get them. I note that there are far more controversial or important issues than global or warming or climate change, including issues that pertain to matters of the individual human body and brain or mind, like, let's say, forced flu inoculations and various psychiatric drugs for controversial disorders like attention deficit disorder that are diagnosed and administered by school psychiatrists to millions of children across our country. And if you believe in a strong mind-body connection, there has to be a spiritual issue here in what is being done to our children. Another example would be the existence of genetic predispositions toward homosexuality. If it is natural, then there is nothing wrong with it. Of course, some of the clever secularists also want to argue that sexual identity is an arbitrary choice, a pure Cartesian disembodied decision, of which it must be noted such autonomous decisions are what inspired the ideal of detached objectivity about science in the first place. So you really see two different sides of the same coin here. There are many other potential examples I haven't the time to detail here, such as the nature and value of man versus animals as postulated by naturalistic evolution, which contributes to our opinions on questions such as the legalization of abortion and the best ways to ensure economic prosperity, etc., as we enter the scene of social science and social scientists. It is interesting that communism was deemed to be a pure application of science. In fact, Newtonian science has been traced to be a direct inspiration for both atomistic individualism and its corollary capitalism, as well as communism, both of which, from different sides of the Christian spectrum, are increasingly maligned these days. This paradox is part and parcel of the crisis Catholicism and the world are now facing. I pray that we may encourage Adventism to escape this vortex. So our challenge is, how has this set of circumstances come about? To answer this question and provide the rationale for why scientists can and have functioned as our contemporary secular priests in Western societies, it is necessary to retrace the basic contours for why science and religion are often perceived to be in conflict with each other today. Following this brief recounting of relatively recent history, I will visit the history behind why science and religion were at their origin point not in conflict, and how their historical harmony concerning the concept of truth gave rise to the sacramental priesthood found in Catholicism. The Crisis of Science and Religion, Part 2. So what has made the priesthood of secular scientists possible? To answer this question properly, we must revisit the recent history concerning the relations of science and religion. It was toward the end of the 19th century when John Draper and Andrew White formally declared that a state of war existed between science and religion. Ever since, these two domains, which both claim to provide an authentic or accurate understanding of what we can know or apprehend about reality, have become increasingly a challenging duet to harmonize before the public and the world of scholarship. Perhaps the most popular recent descriptions for the possible relationship between the two domains of natural science and religion have been Ian Barber's four options of conflict, independence, dialogue, and integration. Without question, there have been advocates for each of these general alternatives throughout recent history. Not surprisingly, within religious circles, efforts at dialogue and integration have been the preferred options. This fact, however, encourages an interesting result. Despite their efforts to interact with the scientific realm, openly religious scholars are typically limited to pursuing their quest exclusively within restricted and sympathetic religious audiences, owing to the broadly secular nature of the mainstream world of scientific research and scholarship in the 21st century and the 20th century, which has shown little interest in the explicit interaction between the science and religion until more recently, like with people such as Sam Harris. The outcome of the situation described above is that despite the efforts of contemporary religionists to engage science, they generally remain effectually funneled by the secular academic mainstream into the first and second relational options, that of conflict or independence. For example, the late agnostic paleontologist and philosopher of science, Stephen Jay Gould, a contemporary of Barber, popularized and encouraged such independence through his support of the two non-overlapping magisteria of science, the rock of ages, and religion, the rock, science, the age of rocks, and religion, the rock of ages. For Gould, religion encourages conclusions, particularly its central claims concerning God, the creation of the cosmos, world, and life, and the concept of the Imago Dei inspiring human exceptionalism and, of course, ethics, that are either not part of natural science's magisterium or are not verifiable, owing to inconclusive and incomplete data, leaving religion generally irrelevant to operational scientific methodology, which I should note, by the way, I should quickly define as including the assumptions of objectivity, determinism, and empirical accessibility. Within such a situation, rather than any explicit conflict or specified independence becoming prominent, the difference between the two becomes almost irrelevant for many non-overlapping aspects of the differing domains, which has been the popular way of trying to treat it, leading most religionists educated in the secular academy to assume a naive harmony between standard operational scientific methodology and religion, whether dialogue or iteration are sought after or ignored. As the Catholic philosopher John Howitt explains, for those who see harmony between science and religion, while critiquing some conservative religionists who are harsh critics of secular science, particularly its conclusions, for example, in evolution and flood geology, Howitt says, it may not be science but scientism that is the enemy of religion. The implicit conflation of science with scientism, they will argue, is what lies at the root of most modern opposition by scientists to religion. Without usually being aware of it, scientific skeptics have uncritically fused the scientific method with scientism, a belief system that assumes, without any scientific demonstration, that science is the only appropriate way of looking at things. And so it is little wonder that they quite ingeniously conclude that science opposes religion. This method of contrast, however, prohibits the conflation of scientific method with any belief system, be it religious or secular, since sooner or later such a facile sort of union leads to unnecessary conflict. Science and reason alone, Hout realizes, is not sufficient. We need science and scripture, tradition, etc. Beyond the very important concept of scientism, which he touched on, which is, defined simply, the conflation or bringing together of the study of the natural world with ethics, what Hout's position, however, also implies is that methodologically, for the most part, secular scientific methodological naturalism and any presuppositionally biblical methodological natural science and theology aren't really any different conceptually. That is, their attitude toward what constitutes the trueness of what is true is the same and operationally. It is only their presuppositions and conclusions which affect their choice of content from the available scientific and biblical and archaeological data that are sometimes radically different. This point here is key. In short, the theistic scientist and biblical or Catholic, it doesn't really matter, theologian may insist that accurate biblical hermeneutics and the accurate conclusions of honest atheistic scientists and philosophers concerning the data of the natural world will arrive at the same conclusions for overlapping questions. Example given, phlegiology. If there is, in fact, only one real reality of objective objects, biblical and natural, to interpret through the scientific methodology. There will be harmony because the harmony is founded upon a presupposition that assumes the scientific method is valid for both biblical theology and natural science. We may differ in our interpretations, but only so long it is believed by both the biblical or theistic scientist and the secular scientist, as we have not yet completed our data collection. So a full data collection will give us harmony. All data would make a single interpretation much easier. This is all very well and good. I want to make very clear. This is all very well and good. And for the most part, of course, even I concur with it. It would be nice to have all the data, which we will never have, as surely as we all would like this for our practical epistemology. However, when it comes to spiritual realities, especially soteriological and ecclesiological realities, matters are a bit more complicated when you bring that human brain into the equation with science. As Sam Harris well knows, everything will begin to break apart. This is because secular science is exhausting itself. It is finding out it needs ethics, just like Sam Harris realizes, to keep its importance and power over society and to respond to the inner conditions of mankind, which every secular scientist, whether or not they believe in free will or not, well realizes. Very importantly, however, as it will prepare us for the next section, philosophical reasoning, as the pursuit of wisdom, has always assumed since the time of Plato and Aristotle the utilization of the scientific method and its rationalistic and empirical aspects through Plato and Aristotle, the scientific method to describe the relationship of various objects in the various domains, however radically, even categorically, different these domains may be. For example, not only natural objects or concepts, but also the psychological and theological. In other words, the idea that what makes a discipline science is neither the object studied nor the method in the tool-oriented sense of microscopes, customer surveys, or Greek lexicons, the method used, but the systematic pursuit of knowledge and its organized presentation has a subtly complex heritage with Greek rationalistic and empirical theology. Section 3, when science was religion. It is a heritage that many Christian theologians today have not per se forgotten, but more importantly, probably misunderstood. And that is our Greek heritage. This is very unfortunate. Let's start with a question. Can truth be mediated through the exercise of authority? Where does the predominant model for the mediation of truth come from historically, particularly as it pertains to its early rise in medieval Christianity? These questions are very important and perplexing to people today. I'm going to give a little summary of Platonism here, because it is important to remind us of how it came about and what its ideal picture looks like and how influential it still remains today. Platonism understood as the division of reality into ideal forms and their imperfect temporal or physical copies, i.e., the chairs here are imperfect copies of ideal chairs somewhere up there in the invisible heavens, illustrates its primal character from the mathematical world. Plato and the two worlds theory would never have existed if it weren't for mathematics. In mathematics, the reality of the truth that, say, 3 plus 4 equals 7, or that the circumference of a circle is pi multiplied by its diameter, pi times d equals c, is not thought to rest in anything other than the reality of the given truths themselves. They are what they are, timelessly and eternally, and humans discover these objective truths rather than create them abstractly through our seemingly unique human minds. There is, evidently, no perfect circle in the physical world which we may measure to attain the solution of pi or acquire a circle's circumference, nor does nature inherently reveal that three trees standing next to four trees represents seven trees. This truth of sevenness is something that we impose on it, and it's thought to be immaterial and eternal, accessible only through the working of our intellect. As Jennifer Fisher puts it succinctly, the idea that there is a world of mathematical objects which is independent of humans and their ways of thinking, but which is accessible to humans through the exercise of reason, is known as Platonism. A lot of us think that way about things like mathematics. Another name for this view is mathematical realism. According to this, the world of mathematical objects is real, though abstract, and mathematical knowledge is a matter of discovery, again, not creation. For the early Platonists, although the idea originated earlier with the Pythagoreans, and their worship of numbers. It's very important to note that his school is understood to have, they kind of worship numbers, the Pythagorean theorem and other kinds of mathematical theorems and other ideas came to us from them. They were very important for them. Their entire school of philosophy, think about that, was centered around mathematics. That was philosophy. It was such immaterial and eternal truths that pertain to the nature of true beings as corporeal natures were incapable of attaining the status of objects of science. And this was articulated very clearly later by Neoplatonists like Iamblichus as they reflected back on Pythagoras, whom he considered the only true philosopher alongside Plato, who inherited from him. Accordingly, ontology, or the science of beings and being as such, consists of the study of mathematical like entities and realities. Platonic ontology studies those things which it purports to really be, objects which are stable and eternal, not merely the appearances of things, such as objects of a physical nature, which are transitory. So you have the ideal, the purer, the more objective world, and you have the less important transitory physical world, and I hope you are aware of the heritage this had in Christian theology. I won't be detailing all of it. The peculiarities of the above realities and their interrelationships constitute the essence of the historical and conceptual development of philosophy, natural science, and theology throughout the Pythagorean, Parmenidean, Platonic, Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, and then Christian, Augustinian, and then later Aristotelian, Aquinas, Thomist thinking. The entire lineage is buried in this kind of thinking. The timeless-like nature of mathematics, which only our mind soul, as it came to be called later, could perceive, is what ultimately inspired, and this is absolutely foundational, this is ultimately what inspired the immortality of the soul, the determinism of Calvinism for humans, the mystical ascent into a higher realm, etc. The timelessness of God runs very deep in its influence on theology. Although many theologians and some philosophers today are not well versed in this history and its very tight connections with mathematics and mathematics' relationship to science and natural science and the philosophy thereof, it is noteworthy that some philosophers of mathematics, like James Brown, are quick to observe that anyone sincerely interested in philosophy must be interested in the nature of mathematics, and I hope to show why in his book. As for those who persist in thinking otherwise, let them burn in hell. You better know your math or else you're not seriously a philosopher. But the point is, historically, theologians and philosophers were also often their generation's leading mathematicians. This is obviously no longer the case. I can't remember the last time the seminary offered anything on mathematics. If today we cannot measure up, although, by the way, mathematics was a key topic, a key subject in the seminaries through the Middle Ages, but no longer. If today we cannot measure up to some degree in our familiarity, again, I'm not buying into it, it's not a good thing, but our familiarity with these disciplines and their interconnectedness in the sciences, at least in acknowledging the fact of their historical relationships, we are doing a disservice to our own historical counterparts of yesteryear, especially if we truly wish to understand why they thought the way that they did. If I took away your Bible and raised you out somewhere far apart from civilization, I would turn you into a Greek, because Greek thinking works. It absolutely works. The alternatives approaches to mathematics, by the way, that are found in Asia and other places, they have a complex but ultimately similar relationship to mathematics, even though they do better emphasize the temporality and importance of the physical world. But the mathematics does lead them into also their mysticism as well, although that's a complex history I cannot trace here. C. Howson summarizes it well. Plato enjoined the study of mathematics as an essential preliminary to philosophy. It taught important epistemological lessons. In particular, it seemed to show that observation yields in the Platonic terminology mere doxa, appearance or opinion, while the intellect alone, unaided or rather unhindered by the senses, could render up the pure distillate of episteme. Line, plane, point, triangle are universals. So are man, state, justice, table, etc. It was not at all obvious that then that the incredibly fruitful methods of contemporary mathematics should not be extended to elicit with equal certainty the nature of the members of the second group, the man, state, justice, etc., table, etc. That is to say, of everything, or rather, if you are Plato, the idea of everything and being as well. The program Plato inaugurated, I'm continuing, quote, in the 4th century BC was to do precisely this, using in particular the method he termed the dialectic, indirect proof or reductio, which he regarded as preeminently the method of proof in mathematics. The eventual result of the dialectical process, Plato believed, would be a systematically unified, complete, a priori knowledge of the hierarchy of ideas, which would include everything in this timeless world. Adumbrating such a program to the later dialogues, Plato bequeathed a methodology for knowledge which was found to be just as compelling in the 17th century AD as it was in the 4th century BC. So the dawn of science saw this very appealing as well. To regard as the domain of truth not the world of sensible objects, but that of ideas whose structure is revealed by means of mathematical or quasi-mathematical proof. That is C. Housen. It is, of course, important to understand that while today it may seem, at first glance, an odd comparison to think of abstract concepts like justice as comparable to any mathematical truth, in actuality, they do indeed have just such a conceptual relationship for Plato, as Mueller interprets Plato. For Plato, the forms constitute some kind of system, again, I'm just emphasizing this, of which it is the task of the philosopher to gain an understanding, this invisible realm of, you know, that is available through the rational assent of the mind. On the whole, the knowledge of forms is conceptual knowledge. Philosophers who know the form corresponding to the term just will have the answer to the question, what is justice? And will be able to assess the justice of particular actions, programs, etc., things which are said to be just by participating or sharing in the form of justice. Of course, there is no source for Plato outside of his own mind. This is very important to emphasize. It is also very important, as I had already noted above, that God, or the divine, in its changing forms and subtle nuances as it developed, was only accessible through the above methods. As the God was, of course, deemed to be the most stable, certain, eternal object. God was timeless, changeless, etc. This was less obvious in Plato himself, but quite clear in his predecessor, Pythagoras, and his succeeding followers, many of the Neoplatonists. Furthermore, although I cannot detail all the developments, Elsbeth Whitney summarizes, Neoplatonism developed the idea that emanations from the One, God, constituted and sustained a great chain of being from the most spiritual or timeless or abstract entities, which were inspired by mathematical type entities, down to the more physical or material ones. So you kind of have this emanation down from the pure to the less pure. Of course, it must be observed that for the soul, which in Plato is an intellectual element, is participating in this timeless world, is the ruling part in the hierarchy internal to the human psyche. So from the body to the mind, this mind has something more special. And so it is the faculty, the mind, through which human beings can apprehend and approach the cosmic hierarchy, assimilating themselves to the divine, which is an essentially timeless, mathematical-inspired world. And Michelini concludes in her evaluation of Plato, because the transcendent superstructure can be apprehended only only intellectually, the authority of those who possess the ability to think abstractly, that is, philosophers, is inscribed in the structure of the universe. I also want to just briefly summarize, as I see time moving, that the Neoplatonists also contributed another key piece, which is the relationship between theology and science, and that is through those like Iamblichus, who defended the practice of theurgy. They realized that it was a lot of effort and work to think mathematically, and that a lot of ordinary people didn't seem to be able to do it very well. And so they created rituals based on mathematical type reasoning and principles, which could help these people better grow or ascend to the divine. And you can read about this in his Divine Mysteries of Egypt and other works. By the way, as Berger Pearson summarizes it, the theurgists, such as Iamblichus, who is 3rd century AD, the divine rituals were effective basically ex opere operato. So this idea comes straight from the Neoplatonists. And he himself notes a comparison with Christian sacramentalism naturally suggests itself. I don't have time to fully go through the history of when religion was science, but when you trace through many of the early Christian thinkers, and particularly when you get into some of the giants like Augustine, you will see a tremendous amount of number worship and mathematics worship. It was very important to him to view God as existing in this timeless realm. There are a number of quotes that point in this direction from him. He frequently lapsed into open mysticism concerning numbers and so forth. I want to note that the linchpin to understanding the role of mathematics and sacramentalism lies in the timeless, objective, and mysterious status of the divine realm they purport to represent and their presence through Neoplatonic emanation in the sensible physical world. So this emanation is the key. Catholics created their theology based on these principles, and it is scientific for them because of it. The fact that certain rituals have been endowed with special power and status is quite compatible with the Greek heritage that I have only briefly described. But one thing I want to note as I get to the end here and give a brief conclusion is that the key for all of this, and I cannot neglect to point this out, is that if the divine is approached through that which is most objective and permanent, timeless and unchanging, yet also somehow inaccessible to the majority, then we fall into both a natural and rationalistic theology that must be mediated for the sake of the lesser masses. Scripture cannot compete with the world of mathematics in absolute certainty and both universal accessibility and also mysteriousness. Of course, for the Catholics and the Greeks, if God is part of this world, then, and this is the conclusion, ethics must also be timelessly participating in it and can also then be shared and mediated as well. So it is infusible into earthly vessels at the priest's command because of it. Of course, there are other ideas that come into play here, but the idea that the ethics exists in the timeless realm and can be exchanged and transported up and down because of it is the key. If ethics is timeless, then it too must be mediated. And the Catholic philosophers know this very well, and they realize because of this that secular science, when it presumes to have inserted ethics into itself, is their greatest competition. I want to point out in just a few concluding thoughts, I could go on my reaction to this at great length. There is the problem of the role that postmodern thinking plays here. And I don't think that we have correctly and fully appreciated exactly what postmodernism contributes as a solution to this. My background in research is on Heidegger and the father of postmodernism, and while it is very true that postmodernism creates a moral relativism, it also creates the only possibility of morality. So the key is actually that there is no story in modernism, there is only determinism, but in postmodernism the opportunity for stories actually exists, and then it becomes a matter of identifying how we can locate the only true meta-narrative. This is complex, and I have several pages that go over some of the details here, but it is the only way out of the rabbit hole that is Greek Platonic thinking. The method of this, as Gary Brent Madison observes, who is an astute philosopher, scientific knowledge is nothing more than the expression of a certain intellectual technique, the scientific method. This technique has proven useful for certain purposes, but the failure on our part to realize its inherent limitations has had as its consequence the accelerating reduction of all cultural values to those of science. He's not a Catholic, but many other Catholics, including some like David Schlender, very well recognize that secular science and Catholic science are indeed the converse. And it's fascinating to read some of his criticisms of the United States and its political and economic and social systems based on this and how he engages that. But I will conclude there by just noting again one more quote that Robert Henley observed in 1969, that science, while not the whole of culture, is the most important. The thought that, Robert Henley observes, of the idea that science, while not the whole of culture, is the most important part and should determine and give meaning to all the rest, leads to a position that denies any independent knowledge value to philosophy or the humanities and, of course, to revelation and theology. He was very prescient in that prediction. which has come very true in people like Sam Harris. Henley adds, science would, if it could, in this new emerging third culture, which seeks to fuse secular science and the real concerns of the humanities or postmodernism, science would displace and play all the knowledge roles played by philosophy, theology, and the humanities in the pre-scientific culture. We, as Seventh-day Adventists, pointing back to a God who talks through Scripture, have the only solution to the crisis that philosophy is facing and which Catholicism itself is now embroiled. Thank you.